My name is John Beck, and I'm the co-director of our Daily Work of Daily Lives. Today, I just have a couple quick announcements, and then I'll introduce our speaker. There are sign-in sheets around the room, so please sign in. Today's lecture is co-sponsored by the Asian Studies Center here at Michigan State University. Thanks to the library that is starting to actually record them here, as well as the recordings that they've done over at the library when we've held sessions over there. So we're looking forward to having all of these archived there in the Vincent Voice Library. So today's speaker is Jim Hesteroy. And Jim is currently serving as an Andrew W. Mellon postdoctoral fellow in Islamic studies at Lake Forest College in Illinois. Earlier than that, he was connected as a postdoc and doing other kinds of things over at the University of Michigan, where he might return. We won't hold it against him if he wears maize and blue for a little bit. Jim finished his PhD at the University of Wisconsin. And since many of you now know that the Wisconsin campus is nearly in flames, since it's close to the Capitol, which is nearly in flames over the governor's current attack on collective bargaining in Wisconsin, as it was pointed out on one of the listservs I'm on earlier today, it's interesting that the media is really reporting this as an attack on worker wages and pensions, when in reality that's not what people are really spending all of their time talking about in Wisconsin. It's about the fact that the governor has targeted collective bargaining to vacate all collective bargaining in Wisconsin, which would really be quite a disaster. But Jim is here today talking about building the Islamic work ethic, tailoring global capitalism for the Indonesian workplace. So thanks for coming, and let me try to hook Jim up. And there you go.
Thank you.
So join me in welcoming Jim.
Thank you. How's the mic volume? Good? All right. Thank you for coming today, and thank you, John, for inviting me. Today's talk will be very informal, and so please feel free to raise your hands, ask questions during the talk, or wait. We also have time for question and answer afterwards, so feel free to just interrupt me at any time. As you can see from the title, I'm looking at Islam in the workplace in Indonesia. And the title itself evokes is kind of in dialogue with a thesis that I'm sure many people know about, this famous sociologist Max Weber, the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism, and is there anything inherent in any religion that cultivates a certain sensibility in terms of participating in the market, entrepreneurship, capitalism, etc. What I want to do is talk about today is, does this really transfer to the study of Islam, and how can we understand this a little bit more by looking at contemporary Indonesia? Aside from my academic life, I've always had kind of one hand in the cookie jar of business and human resources and consulting, and so in terms of my own research, it was a chance to meld my interests in academics and also some of my experience in business in the workplace. And so what I'll be talking about today, and just trying to give you many different glimpses into the workplace in Indonesia, particularly corporate training seminars, and looking at how Western ideas about business have traveled to Indonesia, and then how Indonesians have transformed these Western ideas about business to make them quite compatible with Islam. So I have here the cover photo, Stephen Covey in Jakarta. As many people perhaps know, Stephen Covey, the famous author of Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, that book is a bestseller in Indonesia. You might not have known that. Also, in this particular speech, when he came to the Jakarta Convention Center, he was launching his book, The Eighth Habit, which was, you know, I guess once you've gone on the tour for the seventh habit for so long, you gotta come up with something new. So The Eighth Habit is not only translated into Indonesian, but the Seven Habits training curriculum became very, very popular in Indonesia, particularly in the 1990s. And so this is what I'm going to be discussing today. And so we'll start off with Stephen Covey, and in a roundabout way, come back to, at the end of the talk, come back to this issue about, is there any kind of Islamic ethic of capitalism or entrepreneurship? I don't presume any knowledge about Indonesia or Islam, so please ask me any questions as you have them, and we won't get into too much depth, but just some quick facts about Indonesia that might help set up this talk. It's 250 million people, roughly 87% Muslim, as you may have heard in the news. It's the world's largest Muslim majority country. They had independence after World War II, then they had a couple different experiments with democracy, and then they had three decades of a dictator between 1965 and 1998. At 1998, after this dictator, Suharto, fell, you had an increase in the liberalization of the markets, whereas many of the state-owned enterprises held a lot of the country's wealth. You started to have a privatization process. At the same time, you were having an Islamic revival in Indonesia, really starting after and kind of inspired by the Islamic Revolution in Iran in many ways, but in the 1980s, 1990s, a really big increase in the public display of piety, the expressions of religion, people going more regularly to the mosque to pray, people, in a sense, more proudly wearing their Islamic colors. And under the dictator, Islam, particularly a political Islam, was really shunned and tried to kind of kept under an iron fist. You also, during this time, one of the things that some have said the dictator did well was under his reign, under his kind of tyranny, you had a rapid expansion of a middle class, and particularly a consuming middle class. When you mix that with an Islamic revival, you have a consumption of religious products, but you also have religious marketing for everyday products that appeal to people's religious sensibilities in Indonesia. This is a magazine cover from 2005, one of Indonesia's more popular Islamic magazines. And it says, the spirit of a santri economy. Now, santri is the Indonesian word for a very pious Muslim. And decades ago, a famous anthropologist, Clifford Geertz, went to Indonesia and was looking at this santri class, this merchant class. And he was one of the first people, certainly Indonesians before him had also talked about this, to look at this relationship between religion and a way of being an entrepreneur, a way of being a business person, and how people drew inspiration. And what he noticed in this one village that he did, one of several villages that he did his study in, was that it was the merchant class, the very pious Muslims, who were the most successful entrepreneurs in this area. And he predicted that it would be this merchant class that would end up taking control of Indonesia. This came out about a decade before the dictator took over and really changed the power structure. But so for a long time, you've had this relationship between capitalism, entrepreneurship, and the pious Muslim entrepreneurs. This is another business magazine in Indonesia, SWA. And this was from 2006 or 2007. And it's, as you can see, spiritual company. And they use the English, and this gives you a sense of not just Stephen Covey, but how popular English language, particularly in business language, is in Indonesia. Spiritual company. What the basic thrust behind this article and this magazine special issue is looking at business not as something secular and not as a Western capitalism that is a secular capitalism that goes out and spreads across the world, but that business should have some kind of spiritual and religious element to it. One of the books written by an American, Donna Zohar, that was very popular over there was a book called Spiritual Capital. And she's looking at this idea of how can we have a capitalism that, in her words, goes beyond what capitalism has become, and she calls it kind of a very greedy monster. And how can you give an ethics to capitalism that is compatible and commensurate with religious principles? Also, the Islamic publishing industry during this time, particularly the 1980s, 1990s, increased rapidly. You have an increased middle class who is consuming these products. And here's just a couple examples from the Islam and kind of business section. One of the titles here is, be brave to be rich, be brave to be pious. So the focus, and I just want to underscore this, is not just on getting rich, but can you get rich and also be pious? The one on the right is become rich through piety. So how is it that in inculcating a certain ethical disposition, how is that supposed to then help you become a better entrepreneur or capitalist? You have other books that come out about this one, Sharia marketing. How can you use principles of Sharia more or less Islamic law in your marketing practices? And how can we draw on Islamic teachings to become better marketers? Well, one of their answers is in this book by a couple authors that I interviewed, Marketing Muhammad, The Business Strategies of the Prophet Muhammad in winning your market share or winning competition in the market. And this is really interesting because it's an example of how business, in particular the field of marketing, ideas about marketing have become very popular in Indonesia, and how has it changed the way they think about Islam in particular. And so whereas prior to this kind of boom in business literature, in Indonesia, most of the talk about the Prophet Muhammad was mostly about his life after he received the revelation. And I won't have time to go into it in too much detail, but basically when he was roughly 40 years old, the Prophet Muhammad received this divine revelation and spent the next 22, 23 years of his life preaching it. Prior to that, the Prophet Muhammad was a business person. He was the manager of what became his first wife, of her business. As a young boy, he traveled throughout parts of Syria and Arabia with his uncle, and on these business, he was basically in these, caravans. And so they looked to the example pre-revelation of the Prophet for how to become a good business person. The Prophet, before he even received revelation, was known as Al-Amin, or the trustworthy. And so how can they lead a business that is kind of built on Islamic ethics and inspired by the model of the Prophet? So it's not just about Stephen Covey coming over, let's show you how to have 7 habits of highly effective people, but what were those habits of the Prophet Muhammad that we could emulate? And within the tradition of Islam, no one embodies the teachings of the Quran any better than the Prophet Muhammad. And so perhaps even more so than Jesus for Christianity, the Prophet Muhammad really becomes the model of how to live, not just a religious life, but also a business life. Now, during my research in Indonesia, I focused on a particular, and this is a part of it, I focused on a particular preacher over there who was part preacher, part television evangelist, but also an entrepreneur who owned over 20 companies. He was a shrewd business person. On his television shows, he could make as much as $1,000 US a minute. He sold consumer goods with his brand of MQ, or his management kolbu, or heart management. He sold consumer goods, everything from MQ shampoo to MQ honey. You could get his text messages for self-help business strategies and tips. Every day, if you paid about 20 cents a day, you could get his business tips. Now here's a book that was written about him called A'agim, A Spiritual Marketer. And it focuses on how A'agim uses the practice of marketing to spread not only his business, but to spread Islam, and to spread in what A'agim, this preacher, says is the beauty of Islam. Here he is preaching. Part of my research is I did 2 years, roughly, of research in his Islamic school. I worked for roughly about a month in each of his companies, each of his offices within the Islamic school to see what was going on. And I also followed him around the country. Each week he would travel to different parts of the Indonesian archipelago. He would give sermons to stadium crowds of about 10 to 20,000 people, sometimes 2 a day. He would travel from one region to the other. Monday through Thursday he would travel the country. And on the weekends he'd come back to his Islamic school, and they would have corporate training seminars of some of Indonesia's leading companies, mostly mid-level management and upper management, how to become, different business strategies. Some of them were entrepreneur training, some of them were retirement training. What should you do after retirement? How can you become an entrepreneur and still make money? And in Indonesia, the retirement age is much lower than here, and so people have to have another source of income post-retirement. So I followed A'agim everywhere he went. Oops. Here is a photo of him preaching at Indonesia's largest mosque, Istiqlal Mosque. This is a Sunday afternoon TV show that he would have. The mosque would be packed with 20,000, sometimes 30,000 people. It's one of the biggest mosques in all of Southeast Asia. He was particularly popular with women in Indonesia. He had a very simple message about how to become a good Muslim at home and in the workplace. So he really, part of his self-help allure, and he had advice columns that he would write with his wife, was how to be a good husband, how to be a loving husband, but also how to be a sharp business person. Now, and it wasn't just women that were interested in his teachings about how to, you know, about the home and how to raise a good family. They were interested in his business teachings as well. This is a book launch for a book written by his sister-in-law, Betty Sundari, and she wrote a book, as you can see in the upper left-hand corner, Muslima Goes to CEO, which they didn't translate it as well as they might have, but basically a Muslim woman becomes a CEO. And I love the subtitle of this book. It's Become, you know, Muslim Woman Goes CEO, Become a Momtrepreneur. Not entrepreneur, but a momtrepreneur. And the beauty of it is that it really shows that within Islam, and particularly when people who haven't studied Islam as much, they will look here and they will look at head coverings and automatically think, oh, this must be some kind of conservative Islamic movement going on in Indonesia, which in some ways it is, but it doesn't mean that it's necessarily some form of traditional gender roles. This book is all about how women can be successful and independent, and the importance of women being financially independent. So part of this business movement in Indonesia is offering also a new model for the Muslim woman. And so I just want to stress that early in the talk, that this is in some ways a conservative movement, but in many ways it's breaking out of this conservative form of Islam and really showing a different side, particularly for Muslim women. Agim, as I mentioned, was a televangelist. He also did help produce sitcoms and soap operas, melodramas. To give you a sense of who he was, in this photo I took at one of his TV studios, it's a two-minute filler for a Ramadan program. And during the month of Ramadan, religious programming is everywhere in Indonesia. Everything that gets sold, whatever kind of product, has some kind of religious message on the advertisements. And he's doing a two-minute filler, kind of like a commercial, for one of his programs. And in this program, on the bottom right is a husband, and then behind the camera that you can't see is a child and the husband's wife. Of course, they're actors. And they're getting in a fight. And the husband gets home the first day, and he says, "Honey, what's for dinner?" And she says, "Vegetable soup." And then it cuts to day two. "Honey, what's for dinner?" "Vegetable soup." And he kind of gives this look. Day three, "Honey, what's for dinner?" "Vegetable soup." Gets angry but doesn't say anything. Day five, he just had it. "Honey, what's for dinner?" "Vegetable soup." He says, "Oh my gosh, why do we have to have vegetable soup every single day? Don't you know how to cook anything else, lady?" And then she yells at him, as one might. And then they're in this feud, and they freeze frame. Agim comes into the freeze frame and says, "Men, husbands out there, you should really treat your wives much better than this. You must have loving conversation. Use a kind, soft voice with them. If you're trying to correct their behavior, don't be angry, but explain what you would really like. And women, you too should love your husbands. He cannot yell at you like this, but also think about how beautiful variation in cooking can be." And so in some senses, he's really, you know, giving a very conservative take on husband-wife relations. But then after he says this, he gets out of the frame, the actors go, you know, resume, and they've taken his advice, and the husband stops himself and says, "You know, honey, I'm really sorry. I shouldn't talk to you like that. I really appreciate the fact that you've made dinner." And she says, "Well, thank you for that, and I'm sorry also. I've just been busy taking care of everything this week, and I didn't have time to cook and to shop and get the things that you would want. So please forgive me. I'll try to have better variation." He exits the frame, and then life is good, marital bliss. Now, in similar shows, he does the same for workplace management, how to be a good manager, how to lead your staff in a good way, how to do motivation techniques. Every Monday morning, he gathered his 800 employees in the mosque at his Islamic school and had basically a two-hour motivation and training seminar every single Monday based on the Quran, based on the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad, to give them, as he called, motivasi, or Indonesian for motivation. So this kind of HR model that really promotes motivation, promotes your employees' well-being and satisfaction, this is what drove his business. I also followed him through the political spectrum. Here he is with the president of Indonesia. He was launching his business, his moral movement, and this was a 10K run for the moral movement, and he wanted the president to come and wave the flag. So This gives you a sense of his standing, not just in the business community, not just as an author, not just as a TV preacher, but also a political player in Indonesia who has is connected not just to political power brokers such as the president, but also to some of Indonesia's richest entrepreneurs. One of his financiers for the moral movement is the son, this person Anandia Bakri, of Abu Rizal Bakri, who is one of the richest Indonesians, indeed one of the richest people in Asia, who is often accused, some people think he'll be the next Indonesian president. He's often accused by the everyday people as being a corrupt person. So the story is always more complex. As I mentioned, A'a Gim is a self-help guru as well, and so this is his most famous book, Taking Care of Your Heart, Step-by-Step Management Kolbu. And as I mentioned earlier, it isn't all about just emotion and about heart and about how to have a good life, but he says that managing your heart, managing the inside, these kind of ethical dispositions inside of a person, that is what it takes to become a good capitalist, to be a good entrepreneur. That you must cultivate this sense of, for example, not giving up. He says, you know, pantang putus asa. It is forbidden, and Islam forbids us to give up hope. So even in business, you must strive to succeed. Now, one day when I first met with A'a Gim, I went into his office, and he was preparing for an evening lecture. And this gives you a sense of the extent to which this is a Western phenomenon and also an Islamic phenomenon. And he had two books by his side as he was preparing for his evening sermon. One of them was titled Parting the Curtains to the, you know, to the Path of God, which didn't surprise me. I figured a preacher getting ready to do this. And then next to this one was the book Chicken Soup for the Unsinkable Soul. And it gives you, and this particular book is not just, again, about personal lives, but about business lives and how to become a good business person. So you really have this mixing and this kind of crossing of boundaries of Western pop psychology and business management theory, such as Chicken Soup for the Soul, coming into an Islamic context in Indonesia. As any good academic does, anytime you go into anyone else's house, you always check out their books. You want to see what the collection is and see what it says about people. Here, in the next bookshelf over is books more on from like Islamic philosophers, etc. Here we have a book that says, Even Einstein Doesn't Know, Psycho-Cybernetics, or Revolutionary Psycho-Cybernetics. You have Stephen Covey's Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. Next to that you have, or further down you have A Millionaire Mind, How to Be a Rich Man, what's the other one? And then ESQ, Emotional and Spiritual Quotient. Aside from A'a Gim's, sure.
That photograph.
Yes.
The green marking down there, that looks like a library.
It's his system of keeping track of all of his books. So yeah, he keeps a
typical middle class American activity. When you go to someone's house here, they don't have
it. Yeah, they don't have it marked down there. Sure, sure. Yeah, he prides himself on reading and on books and also, yeah, very unusual. And he actually positions that within Islam as well. He says, look, you know, in the Quran we are told to read and that this is what we must do. And so he says, he also quotes a saying from the Prophet. When I asked him about this, I said, well, is this really Islamic or is this, are you just kind of putting this in an Islamic garb? And it was a misguided question in the first place, and then he reminded me of that, and he said, well, actually, as the Prophet Muhammad says, Prophet Muhammad tells us to seek knowledge as far as we can, even as far as China. So it's a saying of the Prophet that he then evokes and says, so for me to fulfill what the Prophet is saying, I have to read stuff like this. This book, ESQ, or Emotional Spiritual Quotient, is written by a person named Ari Ginanjar. He, next to A'a Gim, is perhaps Indonesia's most famous business trainer. He has these emotional spiritual quotient seminars that he also runs. It costs about, for a weekend seminar, roughly $300. So that's quite a sum here. Imagine how much further it goes in Indonesia. He might have 1,000 employees per session in the grand ballrooms of these luxury hotels in Jakarta. So this is very much an upper middle class phenomenon, people that are really interested in upward economic mobility in Indonesia. To give you another sense of how this kind of sits very comfortably, here's a business seminar, Mars and Venus at Home in the Workplace. And in the center is Dr. John Gray, who you may know of Oprah Book Club fame, his book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. These kind of figures are very popular in Southeast Asia, not just Indonesia, but Southeast Asia, and also more of East Asia, Hong Kong, China. The human resources consulting market is very big. And so here they've invited John Gray because they know that this seminar will sell if you have him as a keynote. Then you have Agim on the left. He's preaching on touching hearts with hearts. And on the right, you have a Chinese Indonesian business person who's non-Muslim, who's talking about the relationship revolution, Tung Desem Waringin, and I'll return to him in a little bit. Underneath the title, I'll just translate a little bit for you. It says, are you serious about attaining success? Are you serious about trying to attain happiness that is eternal? And here they're talking about, you know, that capitalism isn't just about this life. It's not just about becoming a successful entrepreneur. It's about the afterlife. And what you do in business, you have to account for on Judgment Day. And this is an important part that gives kind of a little more evidence that this isn't just some secular form of business that's gone over to Indonesia. And then after that, it says, if you're serious about all of these things, then you must attend this seminar. And then you must pay $150. Here is that Chinese Indonesian business person, Tung Desem Waringin, that I mentioned, with another seminar here. I don't know how many people might have heard the name Tony Robbins, American self-help guru. He's on late at night. One of his most famous books was Awaken the Giant Within. And he was one of the members, key figures, in the corporate firewalking training. That was a movement, as some of you may know, in the US. It started in other places, but in the US was very popular, and all of these managers were trying to inspire and motivate their employees. And so they would bring them on these corporate firewalking training seminars. And if you could firewalk, then you could, you know, in theory, if you could walk on the coals, then you could have, you know, this magical moment, as they called it. And they were using and drawing upon these psychological concepts called neuro-linguistic programming, or NLP. This phrase, NLP, really caught on in Indonesia. And this training seminar, Tung Desem Waringin bought the license from Tony Robbins, and it was expensive. He was also an exclusive trainer for Robert Kiyosaki, who I'll speak about in a little bit. But he buys these licenses probably for $20,000 roughly, and then he is the only person who can lead these particular training seminars in Indonesia. So it has its own business model, similar to any trainers in the US. You can't just use Stephen Covey's material. You have to buy in Edward de Bono, et cetera, et cetera. Here is one of the trainers on the left that is working at Agim's Islamic school, Sena Lesmana. He spends most of his days reading psychology and business management books. Here he's at the firewalking training seminar with Tung Desem Waringin and Tony Robbins, but Tony Robbins was only live via high def from wherever he lives in the US. And he uses this slide. I didn't take the picture. This is the slide that Sena uses for all of his, when he starts a training seminar over the weekend. He'll do what he calls a PowerPoint CV, and he wants to explain all the influences on him. He'll do some of the PowerPoint slides, talk about his schooling in an Islamic boarding school, and then he gets into pictures of him with Western trainers and with Western corporate managers. Another slide that he shows in his CV PowerPoint, and he gave me permission to use these, is with John Gray, the author of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. Here's another one. This is John Mazels on the left. John Mazels was one of Tony Robbins' students who learned corporate firewalking from him, got licensed, got trained, and then paid enough money to where he could hold his own training seminars. He takes those to Bali, Indonesia, and Sena in the middle, one of the Islamic teachers at the Islamic school, Muslim teachers at the Islamic school, got his training also there to where he could become a certified trainer. The first time was just to go through it. Now he's a certified trainer. To give you a sense of the broad transnational element here, on the right is a gentleman named Ernest Wong, who is a Christian trainer from Hong Kong. and has really started to tap the Indonesian market. And he'll go around Indonesia and do these really lively corporate training seminars in English, and then he has an interpreter that goes along with him, and or a translator that translates them. Here's a magazine, training magazine in Indonesia. And they use the English word training and trainer for a corporate trainer, but they just kind of give a little Indonesian inflection. To give you a sense of this here, excellent people for excellent service, on the right-hand side, it talks about, on the top, the six thinking hats of Edward de Bono, and I don't know if anyone who might be familiar with that, a very popular, certainly in the last decade, 15 years, in American corporate training. And then below that, it has training center at the Muamalat Institute, and this is Indonesia's first Islamic bank. And at this bank, to become an employee, you have to go through a training session. And it's very much in the line of corporate training, that you have to understand how to apply Islamic principles. And everyone in the bank has to wear, the men have to wear an Islamic hat. They have to wear a particular shirt. It's kind of a white shirt that pious Muslims, or the santri as they're known in Indonesia, would wear to the mosque, for example. That is your business attire. So they're really trying to Islamize the workplace, both physically and then also through this corporate training. Now, part of the question of this, that drives part of the research project is, does this increased emphasis on Western business and on the individual, is this, that goes along with Western business, is this spreading a particular ethic of individualism? Is it spreading a particular ethic of what we would call in anthropology like a neoliberal person or a neoliberal transitions in the market with the privatization, et cetera? Are we seeing also a shift in how Indonesians think of themselves? Are they championing the Western individualism that is so prominent in so much of the entrepreneur literature in corporate training? And if we look at Indonesia, there might be some evidence to say, yes, indeed, this is happening. This is one book translated into Indonesian, actually by a Saudi Arabian cleric, that says, "Be Yourself." Now, the title of the original work in Arabic is nothing like "Be Yourself," but when it gets translated into this market in Indonesia, it is "Be Yourself," and you have this picture, of course, of this person, guy on the top, kind of stretching himself, really glorifying and championing the individual. This is a slide that I took from one of the training seminars, with permission, that also talks about this emphasis on the individual. And in Indonesia, prior to this, your sense of self wasn't just about you, but it was much more relational. And so your sense of self, as in other places throughout the world, especially in Asia, was much more relational. And so, you know, for example, your family, the idea of shame and honor, et cetera, was very important. It wasn't just about an individual. So one of the people who was doing talent mapping training came up with this slide of self-discovery. And it's the kitty looking in the mirror, and it's not really a kitty, it is a lion. This is a slide from his training, but then the very next slide is this, and I apologize, I seldom put text in slides, much less in a foreign language, but I wanted to show you exactly how he sets up his slides. And in this slide, it is a passage from the Quran, and roughly translated, it says, "Let it be known that every person does good deeds in accordance with their gifts and talents." And this is part of his training session on talent mapping, how to identify your talents as an individual and use these individual talents to then succeed in the business place, succeed as an entrepreneur. And then it says, "And God knows more about your talents and how to use these talents in his path." And so again, business in this sense is thought to be a religious phenomenon, particularly entrepreneur training. Here's another slide of the entrepreneur revolution. If you remember, the Chinese business person Tung Desem Waringin from before is now presenting this seminar with the younger brother of the preacher with whom I worked, Abdurrahman Yuri. It's the entrepreneur revolution. Part of the curriculum for this entrepreneur revolution, and when I had joined it, it was free for everybody in the Islamic school, but it became another popular training session that you'd have to pay $100, $200 to join. Part of the curriculum was based on a book called Rich Dad, Poor Dad. What the rich teach their kids about money that the poor and middle class do not. It was written by an American who lives in Hawaii, Robert Kiyosaki. I was just out in the Bay Area a couple weeks ago, and he was giving training seminars in the Bay Area based on that book for about $500 a day, roughly. This book became very popular, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and especially it has a board game version, the Cash Flow Quadrant. And I won't bore you with all the details, but basically he sets up a very simplistic quadrant, if you haven't seen the book before, saying that you can only become rich if you become an investor and own part of a business. If you just have a salary, you'll never be rich. If you just buy stock, you might get wealthy, but you'll never be super wealthy. The trick is to get out of the rat race. And so as part of the corporate training seminars in the Islamic school, they bring this board game in and have people play it. And as you can see here on the bottom, it says how to get out of the rat race. In the middle here, you have the first part of the game. And if you make enough money, you can get out of that rat race and then play on the big, kind of go around on the big part of the board. And then you pick a dream that you want. And some of the dreams are like, you know, do you want a ski house in Aspen? Do you want, do you want to live on the beach for the rest of your life? Do you want a cottage? And then you go and try and get out of the rat race, as they say. My job when I played it was a janitor, and I was indeed able to get out of the rat race. Of course, the way that the rules are set up for the game, anybody, if you play the game right, could get out of the rat race and become rich. So that's part of this, part of the transition that we're seeing in Indonesia is how basically this kind of the American dream, or one might also say the American myth, that you can just pull yourself up by your bootstraps, that anybody can be rich if you want to, that there aren't these structural challenges and boundaries to whether or not you can be rich. Now in Indonesia, as in America, I think there are plenty of structural boundaries, but this is kind of the ethos that this is trying to promote. So here you have people playing the board game, but when they play the board game, they also bring a sense of their Islamic ideas to the board game. So for example, you can get an extra roll of the dice if you give charity. And so that's built into the original board game. And then when my Muslim interlocutors were playing this game on this day, they said, well, you know, we also have this in Islam, this zakat, right? This almsgiving, mandatory almsgiving is one of the pillars of Islam. You also have other forms of giving money in Islam. And they said, well, we have that as well. And they started telling stories. Yeah, you know, in fact, I was giving money the other day. And then without knowing it, I'm sure it was because of that, I ended up getting fortune some other way. Or we gave money to an orphanage, which is a very kind of prototypical way of giving that is very highly revered in Islam. I gave money to an orphanage, and I didn't worry about that money. I just spent it because it was the right thing to do. And then a couple weeks later, somehow in a business deal, I got double that money back. And so it's a different way of thinking about charity and how charity can yield fortune. Another preacher in Indonesia has a training seminar that he does called The Power of Giving, and that's basically the theme of it. But there is a particular, I would say, Islamic underpinning and an Islamic ethics that go into these corporate training seminars. Here's another slide from one of the training seminars that I was given permission to use. And it says the work paradigm, or the paradigm of how to work. And it says work is a mandate, or kind of a trusteeship. And this word amanah is directly implying God, that your work is part of your relationship to God. What you do in that work, whether you are an ethical business person or not, will be accounted for on Judgment Day. And then on the second passage, it says, work is to have the greatest benefit for the most people. And here it is directly conjuring a saying of the Prophet Muhammad that says the best person is the person who has the most benefit to the most people. And so this is how work is being characterized there, not as some hedonistic form of capitalism that, you know, is just supposed to gain you as much money as you can and become an individual in this individualist Western sense, but no, work should be part of your religious duty, part of your religious life. In a similar way as the Protestant ethic. Let me go here. So for example, in this training seminar, they have the 7 B's to become a successful business person. It's kind of this self-help slogans that they use in these kind of different slogans. The first one, and here's the slide for it, beribadah dengan benar, worship with truth, but it kind of means worship according to the Islamic tradition. And of course, the first slide is a man on the prayer mat praying. And so in a seminar, corporate training about work and about how to be a successful business person, the very first B of the 7 B's is to perform your worship and your duties, your obligations to God routinely and without exception. Just see. And then in this slide, the work ethic of the 5 A's. And what the 5 A's are is it's 5 different Indonesian words that just happen to end in A-S. And so they've turned it into an A-S slogan. And let me just translate these, and this will be the last slide. The one in pink, cerdas, it means be smart. You know, not just academic smart, but be clever, be shrewd, be cunning, but in a good way of cunning, not a negative sense. Tuntas, be thorough in all of your work. Everything you do, be thorough. Down, you know, dot your I's and cross your T's. Qualitas, you can imagine what that is. Quality, have quality to your work. The blue one up there is keras, work hard. And so work hard and keras and cerdas, work hard and work smart. And the final one that I want to end on is be ikhlas. Ikhlas is a word that means sincere. And it means sincere. Part of the meaning is sincere in the path of God. And you must be sincere to have a good work ethic. And that part of your work should be a sincere devotion to God. And that through that, you can attain fortune, you can obtain what they call rezeki, which is fortune. And then that rezeki, that could be considered, if we think about it in the Western sense, as capital or as money. But rezeki itself isn't enough. They say rezeki has to be berkah. It has to become a blessing. And so just money, if it's not earned honestly or with sincerity, will get you nowhere. That's just rezeki. But if you bring an Islamic ethics to your business practices, that fortune then is blessed in a sense by God and becomes a blessed fortune that reflects on you both in this life and in the hereafter. And so whereas with the Protestant ethic in Calvinism, people are proving that they are chosen and predestined for heaven by their business efforts, and their business success is supposed to be a sign and mark this as proof that they've succeeded. But in Islam, it's a bit different. In this version, you must be sincere in your efforts. You must bring an Islamic ethics to your business practices, not to prove that you're somehow pre-chosen, but because there will be a judgment day and you will have to account for your actions on that judgment day. So I think what I would say in closing that in Indonesia, what we see is not just a Western capitalism, a Western neoliberal policies, privatization of market, coming over and dominating Islam and changing the religion. I think what we see in Indonesia is the strength of Islam itself and the importance of Islam in people's daily lives are brought to capitalism and transform it in a certain way to Islamize of capitalism in a particular sense. And now I don't want to create too rosy of a picture. As you might also know, Indonesia is one of the most corrupt countries that is out there. So it has a lot of work. But the fact that it is corrupt and the fact that now you have Islam as the answer, they call Islam as the solution. It draws on a lot of Islamist language about how Islam can be the solution to our woes. In Indonesia, they're saying, look, Islam is the answer to our economic woes. Whereas under the dictator said, we need technology, we need development, and he had technocrats running things. Now that the dictator has fallen, Islam has risen as the answer, as the solution. And so economic development in this new form of Islam in the workplace is not about just business strategy, et cetera. It's about a moral reform and a moral development that will lead to better business practices in theory. So we don't just have a Western domination of Islam going on in the marketplace. What we have is Islam transforming capitalism and entrepreneurship. So thank you very much, and I'll look forward to any comments or questions. Okay. Sure. Sure. The question was, so I can repeat it, are there any unemployment rates, or sorry, are there any unemployment figures in Indonesia, and then if you are, what does that mean in terms of, you know, are you unreligious? Sure. Sure. To the first part of the question, I don't know the exact, you know, I don't know how where the exact statistics are, probably in their Ministry of Labor. It would, any statistics that would be out there, I'd be very dubious of, just because there's so much of an informal economy. I think the second part of your question is particularly interesting, because what happens when you're unemployed, right? And how do we explain someone's lack of success? Here I've been talking a lot about how you explain success, but can we then explain the lack of success based on that person? And it's a problematic issue, just as we have, you know, in the US here, is someone responsible? If you can just pull yourself up by your bootstraps, why don't you? If it's so easy, why don't you just do this? In Indonesia, this particular preacher, he doesn't just have these 7 B's and 5 A's for success. One of his kind of mantras is he tries to stamp out what he calls laziness, malas. And I think this is the problematic element of this kind of Islamic corporate training in Indonesia, is it could then very easily move towards this accounting for people's unemployment based on, and say, oh, they're just lazy, oh, they're not trying hard enough, or they are unreligious. I think that it's too early to tell what's going to happen, in which direction, you know, how much is this really going to have a hold in Indonesia in terms of explaining people's poverty. I think it's so close right now to the end of this 32-year reign of the dictator that people know the corruption that was there. They know that if they wanted any services, they'd have to bribe so-and-so. And they know that the connections to the ruling party is how you got jobs, especially any good job. And so I don't think it's going down that road yet, but I'm a bit concerned that it might. And so after one of these trainings, the Entrepreneur Revolution, I had this exact conversation with the young woman who was part of the training. And I posed it in that way. Well, okay, how do we explain people who aren't successful? And she said, well, they're just not trying hard enough. They're not, in their words, menyempurnakan ikhtiar, or they're not fulfilling their part, the self-initiative, this ikhtiar. They're not fulfilling the self-initiative. And then others might say, you know, there's also a formula for success. Ikhtiar, the self-initiative, is one of them. Another one is zikr, which is this kind of remembrance of God. Some have said, oh, maybe they're not leading this life enough. So I don't know what direction it's going to go into, but that's, I think, the problematic of this take on Islamic training. Or do you have...
Go ahead. Is there a growing middle class in Indonesia? And if so, do they tweet?
Yeah, is there a growing middle class in Indonesia? And if so, do they tweet? There's an increasing middle class in Indonesia. Certainly, if you look at the transitions in Indonesia in the last 40 years, if we want to just take the period of the dictator from 65 to 98, you had a massive urbanization. You also had an increase in literacy rates that was incredible. You had an increase in the number of televisions that went into homes. And the reason I bring that up is not just people who can afford them, but also the creation of this kind of national sense of being Indonesian. So you have a huge middle class. Now, you also have huge poverty. I mean, you know, the poverty rates in Indonesia is staggering. Do they tweet? Yes, absolutely. Indonesia, I haven't seen the latest figures, but for a while it was the second most Facebook users in the world. Media technologies, particularly among among the middle class, you know, they adapt to new technologies faster than Americans adapt to new technologies. So that, you know, Twitter maybe not as prevalent in terms of the number of people who are tweeting, but when, for example, when President Obama went over there recently, there was a big to-do over one of the very conservative Muslims who is the Minister of Communication and Information. And he went out and grabbed Michelle Obama's hand to shake her hand, which in his more conservative circles, he shouldn't have touched her hand. He should have just kind of done something like this. But he touched it, and there was this backlash against him, this uproar that went out on Twitter. And then he tweeted right back and said, oh, no. She grabbed my hand first. And then the news across the country showed the actual clip. And so, you know, Twitter and those kind of media technologies really do play a role in the everyday politics, but also in people's daily lives. Another person who I didn't have time, I didn't want to throw you too many people. I may have already shown you too many. Antonio Shafi'i, who has a service also where you can get his text messages for business success. He runs the first university in Indonesia that both presents both Western business and Islamic finance. And so he, you know, also sells these text messages for business success. So media technologies are very important there. So the question being, might there be a revolt, and given their use of technologies, increasing middle class? Could I see it happening? Actually, it's already happened. Indonesia had, in 1998, when this dictator fell, had this transition, a student movement. And now most people, especially those who were taken, you know, blindsided by the events in Egypt, there's been a couple articles recently that now the State Department officials are trying to look at the way that Indonesia transformed itself into a democratic polity. And it's far from perfect right now, but it represents the trajectory that Americans in the State Department want to see. So they're actually looking at Indonesia as a model. By and large, political parties do not fare well in Indonesia. In the last two elections, they have not received that great of a vote. But they also, Indonesians don't just want secular democracy. They don't want just liberal secular democracy. They want a democracy, but they want its moral compass to be Islam. Yes?
As you were talking, I was reminded of my own experience in the HR management field in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Mm-hmm. We were bombarded with buzzwords and management techniques, and trainers. And
sure.
At a certain point in time, the question became proven. Does it work? Is there any kind of empirical curiosity in Indonesia as they hear about these various approaches as to what works and what doesn't?
Mm-hmm.
The first part of my question. And the second is, I don't think I heard you mention Japan.
Okay.
Japanese management techniques.
Yeah.
But that seemed almost to be a counterpoint to some of the human relations soft approaches that we were exposed to, mm-hmm. in that period of time. Along came Deming, along came statistics, along came continuous improvement. And with that, I think more sustainability. Can you react to it?
Sure, absolutely. The first question, I'll repeat for our friends in the library later. Is there any empirical data prove it? What's happening in Indonesia in terms of either asking for this kind of data or providing the data? It's really interesting. In Indonesia, the program ESQ that I mentioned, for example, Emotional Spiritual Quotient for Business Training, has a every Tuesday in the Islamic newspaper Republika, they pay for an entire page, and that whole page is stories about recent training sessions, and then they pick very famous people, politicians, business leaders, etc., to give their testimonies that this has worked. And then in a journal called the Journal of Islamic Psychology, that was inaugural journal in 2005, the organization started in 1994, in their inaugural edition of this journal, they had an article about the preacher A'ah Gim, his MQ training. And the title was more or less, How MQ Training is Proven to Be Successful in Increasing Worker Productivity and the Ethical Disposition of State Employees of these state-owned enterprises. Now, they prove it with a T-test. Now, I became an anthropologist because I couldn't spell T-test, but what I do remember is that you can't prove anything with a T-test. So it's proven, but you know, in terms of society going through this, how can we really approve this? But it's not, you know, the ways of proving it, just like, you know, did corporate training in America really ever do anything, are really kind of shady. Some of the training seminars.
Mm-hmm.
Quick answer is no. Just because it's tied on to faith, they would really say, you know, no. We want real answers. Science itself, as a method of thinking and understanding, is very much valued. The second part of your question is also interesting. What about Japanese management approaches, etc.? In a different training seminar, actually for a civic volunteer training seminar, that they use similar models and approaches. They were addressing the issue, and this gets back to the idea of laziness. They were addressing the problem of laziness among employees in Indonesia. And they said, let's look at this one person who had a master's in human resources management or organizational psychology, organizational management from Japan, actually. And he was telling the story of what's the name of the train? Shikasa or the Japanese train. And he's talking about how efficient Japan is and just how Indonesians. And then he gave out statistics about how Japanese, some study that Japanese are among the fastest walkers in the world. And he did this country breakdown, and then he said, Indonesians are the slowest walkers in the world. They walk at the slowest pace in the world. See, we're just lazy, and we need to learn from people like the Japanese who are efficient and do everything quickly. So Japanese models are sometimes models of management, and also corporate models, Japanese and also Korea, are sometimes evoked and used in these training sessions. I wouldn't say it's that prominent. It's not that prominent. But also, there's a colonial history there, too. Japanese basically took over most of Indonesia from the Dutch during World War II. And there's kind of a love-hate relationship with the Japanese. The Japanese were just brutal, probably way more brutal than the Dutch had been. But there was also a respect for how Japan was able to, you know, drive off these conquerors, the Dutch, who had been holding Indonesia for, you know, a stranglehold for a couple centuries.
Let me follow up on Bill's question. I think that another way of thinking about this is that much of what you've laid out is what we often call, you know, kind of pop management.
Sure. Yeah.
Across the nation. So by its very nature, there's an alternative to that, which would be the Peter Drucker School of Management, you know, traditional kind of are we doing the right things, are we doing them well, you know, the Deming and other stuff that's built it. So that, in effect, it's a counter-narrative to the Hollywood version of pop management, okay? So to what degree is Indonesia caught in the and to what degree are corporations also side by side with that doing the counter narrative, which is doing the right things, doing them well, good, rigid, traditional managerial practice, and everything else?
So the question, you know, to what extent is this a pop, or to what extent is there also a counter pop management presence in Indonesia, particularly in the corporations themselves? The quick answer, and I'll try and be as quick as I can be. The quick answer is that the phenomenon, certainly in the public realm, is all mostly pop phenomenon. And it's interesting that you bring up Drucker, because even Drucker is perceived as within the pop management techniques over there. So they had an article on it. They had an article, I can't remember, did he pass away about a few years ago. Anyway, they had an article about him, and I forget if it was about his final book or something. They had an article about him, and it interviewed one of his former students or something. So even Drucker himself is within this pop model. Now, in terms of the corporations and the businesses that are actually in Indonesia, some of them are caught into this pop management system. Certainly, the author of the book, A Spiritual Marketer, who wrote it about this preacher, runs Indonesia's biggest marketing company, and I did some of my research in his company, and he is very much in the pop model. So if you go into the bookstore, his name is Hermawan Kartajaya. You can buy 9 books: Kartajaya on branding, Kartajaya on positioning, Kartajaya on this, that. He works in close association with Philip Kotler at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Business, a very famous international marketing figure. Now, I think there's a level of realism to the other companies in Indonesia, particularly the state-owned enterprises. Even though they are putting their employees by the thousands through these training seminars, most people still think and know that in Indonesia, business transactions and getting contracts and all of this requires kickbacks. And, you know, there's these two systems operating at the same time. And so most people know that that's still the way of doing business. Not everyone does it, but I think for most corporations, it is still a very much good old boy system there. And so you have some companies and managers of very successful companies saying you have to do it the right way, but the number of conglomerates and interconnected, you know, wealthy families that really just use state connections with the state and connections with other private entrepreneurs to get their business done, I think that's still the norm. Yes, Mara. Sure. Sure.
But typically the Islamic reformist movements have been described as returning to the sources, the Islamic sources, and then the counter movements to embracing Western models. And here you've got sort of both going on at the same time in Indonesia. I was wondering if you could describe that in terms of some of these other Islamic reformists.
Sure. Thank you. In terms of context for the broader movement and also locating this historically, I kind of, for today's purpose, use 1998 as kind of a placeholder to discuss a couple shifts in Indonesian, particularly political and business history. But the actual, you know, as you pointed out also, the Islamic revival in Indonesia, as in many other places, was really happening in the beginning to really take root in the 80s and 90s. There, in terms of the movement and the reform and this use of particularly Western science, et cetera, there was a campus, what we call Islamic scholars called Da'wah movement, or this kind of proselytization or propagation. In Indonesia, as elsewhere, it really had this hold in the college campuses in the 80s. A guy, Imaduddin Abdurrahim, who was put in jail. He was a very prominent Muslim, put in jail by this dictator, Suharto, because he was trying to make Islam a very political presence on the campuses. He started this training program in Bandung, the city where I did my research. It's a huge city of about 5 million people, a couple hours away from Jakarta. The Bandung Institute of Technology on this campus is where he started these training sessions. And then some of his students, he would also be sent to the U.S. when he got out of jail, to the U.S. to train Indonesian students studying abroad. He drew heavily from science, heavily from some parts of Western science and technology, but then also, as you said, you know, he was also in some ways counter, you know, it was against what he perceived to be the Western hegemony that was kind of coming into Indonesia. He also was, some of his students founded this university, Paramadina University, which became a very big center for kind of liberal political thought in Indonesia. It also became one of the first places that these training sessions took hold, really took hold in terms of a public outside of the campus. And they had these training sessions that drew heavily on New Age psychology. Anthropologist Julia Day Howell has written about this. So they had these very the well-to-do upper class in Jakarta would attend these training sessions outside at Paramedina, which is just outside of Jakarta. In terms of how this works with the other protests or kind of reform movements and a return to the basic sources, it's interesting in that they perceive themselves in this movement, this kind of upper middle class movement of trainers, they perceive themselves to be doing both at the same time. And it's kind of perplexes me as well. In some ways, they're returning to the sources and they're returning to Islam as the ultimate example. And this is where the Prophet Muhammad, as I mentioned earlier, becomes the ultimate example of a business person. But at the same time, they're very comfortable drawing from Western models of business. And it is, and I'll kind of end with this, the preacher says, look, this is also very political. He said, how can the Ummah, how can this Muslim, worldwide global Muslim community best adapt to the future? The very way that we got, got put in a stranglehold under colonialism by the colonial powers. They had economic power over us. So the way forward for him is about making the Muslim community worldwide a rich community, because with that, then he thinks comes the power. And so it's kind of side by side, and it's hard to pinpoint this particular part of the reform movement in Indonesia. There are other reformist elements in Indonesia that really, shun any of this kind of stuff, and they say, look, this is just awful. We do need to return to the original sources, the way of the Salafi path, and they don't buy into this at all. But in terms of the state of pop culture, it would buy into it. But a lot of those other reformist movements like Hizb ut-Tahrir, interestingly, Hizb ut-Tahrir, they go against Western hegemony, but through training sessions. And they have their own PowerPoint training sessions. So it's a really hybrid mix. And it's, I present some of this work once at a conference, and Charles Herskind, who you know of, this anthropologist doing work on Islam in Egypt, looks at this and he says, Tony Robbins firewalking in Indonesia? This is just crazy. This isn't Islam. Well, in many ways, it is Islam, and it's Islam Muslims negotiating what's part of their tradition and what they can borrow from the other traditions, and still without losing the Islamic element to it.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.